Okay. So this class has been a little bit of a Hanukkah miracle in that there was only one topic and it's lasted for 6 or 7 sessions. When I was in Snicha, someone pointed out that that is the real Hanukkah miracle, is that there's only one Dvar Torah and it seems to last 8 days. It's true with Hanukkah songs as well. Today we're actually going to do something a little bit the same and a little bit different. We're going to study the different accounts of the Hanukkah story. A lot of what we've been taught doesn't really jive with historical accounts or even with accounts of Chazal. We're going to study some of the accounts of Josephus on the Hanukkah story, and we're going to see why Josephus wasn't actually ever banned. I'm going to tell that to you straight up. However, Josephus was the object of quite a bit of ridicule from sources that range from secular historians to Jewish historians, non-Jewish historians to Jewish secular historians to classic Jewish commentators. So we're going to see, being the object of ridicule is not being the object of a ban, and perhaps we could do another session about famous Jews that were ridiculed, but we never finished, and it would be autobiographical. So we're going to study it, that's kind of what our roadmap is for today. But we're going to follow the usual format that we did with all of our other classes, which is that first we're going to give a little bit of an overview, a biography of our victim for this evening. Josephus was a first century Roman Jew who also was a historian. He lived in the time that we associate with what we call the time of Churban HaBayis, the destruction of the Second Temple by the Romans. And he recorded Jewish history in the first century. This included, the history that he recorded, included the war between the Romans and the Jews that did lead to the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. In fact, he fought the Romans in the Galilee and the Galilee between the years 69 and the years 73. During this time, the history that he recorded, he is considered to be among the first, if not the first, to record anything about the life of Jesus. There was really no historians, no actual historical literature as opposed to hagiographic literature. Josephus also wasn't a hagiographer. Anybody familiar with that term? Somebody who records the life of saints. So we actually use that term in the context of our class on making of a gadol. You don't have to write about saints to be a hagiographer. You could write like a hagiographer does, writing extremely laudatory types of accounts that are not even in the slightest bit objective. This is one of the things that led to the making of a gadol that we spoke about a few weeks ago. When I was younger, I thought that Josephus was an apostate. It's not true. Josephus was religiously observant. He was a practicing Jew. But he was, I guess you could say, a predecessor, a precursor to what we might call, I don't want to say Torah Umata, but he was very much, he was very much comfortable in terms of being a citizen of the Roman Empire. He believed that you could be a good Jew and a good Roman. And if you could ever think of two philosophies that were ever diametrically opposed, but Josephus believed that there is no contradiction between Jewish philosophy and Greco-Roman philosophy. Now, you'll recall that we talked about Moses Mendelssohn. Moses Mendelssohn was of the view that it was absolutely possible to be a good Jew and a good German, and that being a good German was part of the values espoused by German society were definitely part of being a good Jew as well. Those of you who were in the Moses Mendelssohn class, and even if you were not, I'm going to Bli Neder send you an article by Alan Nadler. Anybody familiar with Alan Nadler? Burl Nadler, our member. It's his brother. He's a professor at Drew University, and he actually published an article today about the contemporary relevance of Moses Mendelssohn. And this is, he did. That's right. So he just now wrote a sort of a review about the contemporary relevance of Moses Mendelssohn, in which he essentially asserted that Moses Mendelssohn is completely irrelevant to the modern Jew. So I'll send that out. He was really the first to, among the first to believe that if you're living in this foreign kind of society, you can still, the values of this society, of the Greco-Roman society, are not antithetical to Jewish value. And he also believed that it was important to find favor in the eyes of the Romans. Now, this attitude of the importance of finding favor in the eyes of the Romans is not actually foreign to the literature of Chazal. We find, especially in the accounts of the Agadah of the Churban, in the Gemara, in the Gittin, there's, in fact, one of the Rabbi Zachariah ben Avkolas. The Gemara talks about how Rabbi Zachariah ben Avkolas refused to offer a sacrifice that had a blemish in it because he thought that people would, so the people would think that you're all allowed to offer a sacrifice that has a blemish on it. And he was taken to task because this is not the time to be breaking out all the technicalities. There was this sense that as much as possible we should not be rocking the boat with the Romans, and we should do what we could to not to ingratiate ourselves, but not to upset them. The Gemara has numerous accounts of dialogue between different Amoraim and different Roman centurions, but the idea was that if we don't bother them too much, they'll leave us alone. But that's different than it being sort of a pillar of your worldview that it's important to be a good Roman. And it's important to be friends with the Romans. Yes?
What did the sacrifice with the blemish have to do with Romans?
They was sent by a Roman, was sent by Hurdus, actually. So,
which values of Roman Greek values did he get?
So that's a good question. He essentially bought into the whole thing. Now, I don't know whether he bought into the orgies and the idol worship, and the pagan, but certainly emphasis on aesthetics. Sorry. Right, hedonism. Right. Now, well, so Esther used a very important word, which we will get back to. As another piece of background, Josephus was a Kohen. He used to sign it Yosef ben Matityahu HaKohen, or Yosifon. Really, we don't find, he's known as Flavius Josephus, but he never signed his name as Flavius. He later became close to the Flavian family that was ruling Rome at the time. And so that's why the name Flavius was appended to his name. But he was not, he never signed that name. And as a young man, he was sent to Rome to negotiate the release of several Kohanim who were taken hostage. He was sent to the infamous Emperor Nero, probably familiar with the depraved exploits of Nero, but he was sent to Nero to negotiate their release, and apparently he was successful. During the siege at Yotvat, the Romans invaded this town, and the survivors of the Roman siege, they all committed suicide. According to Josephus, Josephus didn't commit suicide. Josephus was a survivor, and he claimed in his account that he was trapped in a cave with 40 other survivors. The circumstances under which this happened were not particularly clear. And once they discovered where he was, the Romans asked him to surrender, but he was ready to. But his companions, who apparently were real buzzkills, they refused to allow him to surrender. And therefore, he suggested another method of collective suicide, in which they would draw lots, and then they would kill each other one by one, counting every third person. Somehow, Josephus was the only one who survived. This actually is known in mathematics as the Josephus problem. How it was possible for Josephus to survive. Now we know of Russian roulette. Right, Russian roulette, where you have one loaded chamber, don't have to tell you, right? But so before Russian roulette, there was Roman roulette. Roman roulette is the Josephus problem. That's really the term in which you take lots and see who, if you have a situation like this, who gets killed and who survives, and ultimately one person will. So it's actually a complex mathematical problem. And somehow Josephus managed to figure out a way in which he would be the only one who would be left standing. And then, guess what? He surrendered. So he surrendered, and there was another soldier. Him and another soldier, they surrendered to the Roman forces in July in the year of 67, actual 67, not 1960, and they became prisoners. As Roman prisoners, the Roman forces were led at the time by Vespasian. The Gemara talks about him as Aspasianus. The Gemara does peg the events of the Churban to the Pulmus Aspasianus, the war of Vespasian, and also talks about Titus. Titus was the son of Vespasian. They both became Roman emperors, and so in the year 69, Josephus was released, and according to his own account, he appears to have played a role as a negotiator during the siege of Jerusalem in the year 70. It's not really mentioned so much in the accounts of Chazal. It was in the accounts of Chazal, the Gemara talks about Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai's negotiation in which he was unable to save the city of Jerusalem, but was able to save some of its inhabitants, namely Yavne v'Chachameha, in which he felt that it was most important, or critically important, to preserve the infrastructure of the Jewish people, even if it wouldn't be in Yerushalayim. And so he saved the Sanhedrin, which the Gemara talks about, how the Sanhedrin moved around from Yavne to different places, to Tzipori, for example, up north. And you can even see those locations now. He arrived in Rome in the entourage of Titus, and he became a Roman citizen during the ruling of the Flavian dynasty. That's why we just mentioned that he's referred to as Flavius Josephus. And he also was granted accommodation to live in Judea, which had been conquered by the Romans. And he was given a pension. Wasn't a particularly great pension, but it was a good enough pension. And there, while he was living in Rome, that's when he wrote all of his known works. So, and there are many, many volumes. There's the Antiquities of the Jews, there's the Bellum Judaeum, the Wars of the Jews. Those are the two most, and the Antiquities of the Jews has something like 20 volumes. And the War of the Jews has a little bit less, but there's quite a lot there. He was married a few times. His first wife perished in the siege in Jerusalem, along with his parents. Vespasian arranged for him to marry a Jewish woman who had been captured. And then that woman left Josephus, and so at the age of 70, he married a Jewish woman from Alexandria. Alexandria was one of the great Jewish communities at the time, and he actually had three children with her, three male children, already after the age of 70. You had a question. I'm sorry.
So he went from surrendering to slavery to settling in a pension?
Going from slavery to having a pension actually happened in last week's parsha. Right, it's not unknown. And by the way, but you raise a good point. It almost defies belief, and that is why he became a very controversial figure. Josephus was a very controversial figure, and we're going to see that there were those who hated his work. Let's look at the first source.
Was he a collaborator?
Was he a collaborator?
You can also come back and talk about the context for a minute. Like, why were the other Jews committing suicide? What was it that they were so freaked out about?
Do you know what it was like to live under the Romans? And it was also a question of forcible conversion and possible violation of, if not all of, then certainly some of the three cardinal sins, gilui arayos, sexual immorality, shfichas damim, murder, and avodah zarah, idolatry. It was not exactly the best of situation, and certainly it meant a sacrifice of freedom. Yes?
But also, is it true this was a time of extremists? This is a time of the different religious sects.
Yes, that's another important point.
And also this is the time of the brain fade, the guys up on the mountain.
The Essenes?
Masada? Right.
Yeah.
All these times, that's what people did. To me,
it's really...
And also Rabbi Yochanan wasn't he the one who...
He didn't commit suicide.
I understand, but he was threatened with death if he left Jerusalem, was that...
Right, and that he played
dead. Yeah, he
right. Had to play dead.
He could have been put to death.
Correct.
By fellow Jews.
Correct. That's right, the Bir Yonim. The Gemara and Gittin talks about the... You're right, the brutes. Biryon, by the way, is a term in modern Hebrew for somebody who's brutish and stupid but physically strong. People who were hot-headed and were zealots, and they, instead of exercising diplomacy, as Lazari pointed out, they actually ruined it for everybody. But there were other sects, like Qumran, for example, if you've been to Qumran, right? But that's not the only place that sects like this existed, sort of proto-Jewish sects.
It's so extreme. Like, couldn't they just say, like in other time periods, look, just what those people are doing, but in our family, this is what we believe, or in our family, we don't, we like to keep our clothes on.
And die. Yeah, you could certainly. The people did die, and were martyred for those beliefs. Yes.
So you're saying it was even the other people's.
Whether they should have committed suicide or not is a different discussion. I always find it strange that bar mitzvah ceremonies are conducted at Masada. That's perhaps a different discussion, but. It's really, which is the ceremony that marks your entrance into the Jewish people, and you're obligating yourself to the laws of Judaism, is conducted at a site that actually stands for placing personal autonomy above the value of Judaism.
The Israeli army no longer holds ceremonies there because of that.
Right.
I mean, those Jews attacked other Jews who were at Ein Gedi.
That's right. That's right. So it was an interesting time, as you can imagine. Listen to what E. Mary Smallwood writes in her introduction to the translation of the Wars of the Jews. Josephus was conceited, not only about his own learning, but also about the opinions held of him as commander both by the Galileans and by the Romans. He was a legend in his own mind, Josephus. He was guilty of shocking duplicity. At the Jarta Pata, Yod Pata, right? That was the, in which he somehow managed to be the only survivor, saving himself by sacrifice of his companions. He was too naive to see how he stood condemned out of his own mouth for his conduct. The very fact that he was alive was a damning, it was a condemnation of really who he was, and yet no words were too harsh when he was blackening his opponents. And after landing, however involuntarily in the Roman camp, he turned his captivity to his own advantage and benefited for the rest of his days from his change of side. So what was he doing? He was a collaborator. Esther said that he was an opportunist. The two are pretty much, one is the forerunner of the other. In general, he was an opportunist. Found himself in captivity, and so he began to collaborate with the Romans, especially considering that he had a worldview in which it was okay, and in fact even encouraged to be a good Roman.
How old was he at the time that he survived that suicide thing?
Probably in his late, in his 50s, something like that, 60s. So it was all about saving himself. And whatever it took, the very fact that he placed his own life and his own comfort above the lives of his of other people that were with him led to universal or a lot of condemnation. And in fact, Josephus really tried to anticipate that others would condemn his action. But for some of our own principal men, this is the next source, their mouths are wide open, and their tongues loose presently, for gain in lawsuits, but quite muzzled up when they are to write history, where they must speak truth and gather facts together with a great deal of pains. And so they leave the writing such histories to weaker people, and such as are not acquainted with the actions of princes. What's he saying? Though there are people who don't know how to write history, those people are weaklings. But I am not a weakling, and I don't care what anybody says about me, because I know what I did, and I know that was right. Yet the real truth of historical facts be preferred by us, however so much it be neglected among the Greek historians. And parenthetically, the people that don't know how to write history were the Greeks. The Greeks, he said, were the people who tended to paper over unpleasant things. He says, but I am writing this, and I'm going to show that I am correct, and that my actions were correct. So this is what Josephus wrote, actually, in his commentary on the Torah. The Abarbanel had some choice words to say about Josephus, and he, in connection with his account of certain events, Joseph ben Matityahu falsified the truth and the Holy Scriptures, with the purpose of flattering the Romans, like a servant in the strong hands of his master, speaking at his dictates. What was he saying about Josephus? He was a puppet. He was like a marionette, is what he was a puppet. And his intention was to present the Romans with what they desired. He was telling them what they wanted to hear. He was presenting an account of history that would be flattering and laudatory to the Romans at the expense of the Jews. He was selling out the Jews. And therefore, he did not hesitate to delineate from the written word. He was deviating from the Torah. And in my eyes, that is in my eyes, punishable sin. A punishable sin, and that is foolishness. In other words, and why was it so bad, why was it so terrible that Josephus wrote accounts of history that deviate from, let's say, the accepted tradition? We talked about this when we talked about Azariah de Rossi. It was that Josephus was a religious person. If there's one thing that comes up again and again in the context of the banned books that we discussed, it's that when it comes from the inside, that is the biggest offense. Right? The greatest condemnation is always rained down on the people who are criticizing from within, or who are from within the camp and say things that deviate from the party line or from the standard narrative. That is why, yes.
Was he a historian before this whole
Yeah.
changing thing happened?
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of things did he write before? Did he write an ocean?
So no, he was always writing history of the Romans, things that he experienced even. But when he wrote things that deviated from the standard, this is why the Abarbanel had to criticize him. Now, what we had said, it's not necessarily true. For example, that Moses Mendelssohn was completely on the inside, but we did say that Moses Mendelssohn was a completely observant Jew, and that was one of the reasons that he was such an object of controversy. The Rambam was. Was an insider. Azariah de Rossi, also an insider. Told us Yaakov Yosef of Polna, the Talmud of the Baal Shem Tov, but with first, what used to be what? He used to be a misnagid, Rav Nassim Kamenetsky, the ultimate insider in the modern yeshiva world, and Rav Kook, the great Talmudist, the great Talmud Chacham, who studied something like 70 block Gemara every day, when he said things like that the nation should be unified and so forth. This is a slap in the face. So this is why, this is another reason why Josephus was the object of such, and also because he, that's one reason. The other reason is that he was perceived as being a turncoat, as being an opportunist, a collaborator. I'm going to see that a little bit more. Now, given this perspective, go ahead.
So, in other words, did he always plan with Romans in his writings even before?
Very good. So we're going to use the Josephus' writing about Hanukkah to see. We're going to try and see whether this passes the test. Is when he writes about Hanukkah, is he trying to flatter the Romans, or is he trying to tell it like it is? So we're going to do some comparative literature here.
Was Hanukkah pre or post captivity?
Good question. Pre. So let's look at the account in the Sefer HaMakabim, the Book of Maccabees, about the story of Hanukkah. By the way, more modern historians, there's one more modern historian named Joseph Lacker, who wrote that the only thing he ever believed about Josephus was that he was born. that virtually nothing else is trustworthy about anything that he wrote. Okay, so...
No.
People actually cared about historical standards, but at the same time, right, when you're writing with an agenda, everybody has an agenda, right? The history is written by
the victors,
and Josephus managed to do pretty well for himself. So that's why. Okay, the first book of Maccabees. And they arose in the morning of the 25th day of the 9th month, which is the month of Kislev, pardon the translation, in the 148th year, and they offered sacrifice according to the law upon the new altar of Holocaust, which they had made. That word has been somewhat redefined, but actually it means burning. It means a fire, okay? Korbanos, they're often burned completely, korban ola, and so forth, according to the time, according to the day wherein the heathens had defiled it. In the same, it was dedicated anew with canticles and harps and lutes and cymbals. They had a big party. And all the people fell upon their faces and blessed up to heaven him that had prospered them. And they kept the dedication of the altar 8 days, and they offered sacrifices. Let's just use the word sacrifices, because using that other word, Holocaust, is a little jarring in this context. Sacrifices of salvation and of praise. And let's skip to the last one. And Judas and his brethren and all the church of Israel decreed that the day of the dedication of the altar should be kept in its season from year to year for 8 days, from the 25th day of the month of Kislev, with joy and gladness. Okay. Sefer HaMakabim, the first source, talks about the manner in which the Chanukas Habayis, the rededication of the Beis Hamikdash, took place, and that what was the reason, what was the cause of the celebration? Is there any mention of any miracle at all?
No.
Nothing, right? And what was the cause for the celebration? It was rededication, right? And that's what Chanukah also means. Chanukah also from the language of Chinuch, which is one of the processes in terms of rededication, is the usage of the kelim, of the vessels, in the Beis HaMikdash. Let's skip two sources. We'll go back to those. Sefer HaMakabim, the second book of Maccabees. Now, upon the same day that the temple had been polluted by the strangers, on the very same day it was cleansed again, to wit, on the 25th day of the month of Kislev. So now we know, first of all, we from the first source, we know that it was a celebration of 8 days, and we know why it was 8 days, because it was a celebration of the rededication. But in the first source, does it say anything about why it was 8 days?
No.
It says nothing. So let's read the sixth verse. And they kept 8 days with joy, after the manner of the Feast of the Tabernacles. What was it? Sukkot. Sukkot had 8 days. Hanukkah has 8 days. remembering that not long before they had kept the Feast of the Tabernacles when they were in the mountains and in dens like wild beasts. They didn't have the chance to really keep Sukkot, so they just went to the last yontav that they missed. Can you imagine if the last yontav they missed was Pesach? We'd be eating matzah for 8 days on Hanukkah, right? Therefore, they now carried... would only be one day. Therefore, they now carried boughs and green branches and palms for him that had given them good success in cleansing his place. And they ordained by a common statute and decree that all the nations of the Jews should keep those days every year. Okay, 8 days. So we know that there was a yontif, kind of yontif, right? That was declared because of the rededication. And the reason for the 8 days was that that Sukkot had been 8 days. And, yeah.
7 days?
Well, there was one day. Oh, so very good. That's true. But it was in the manner of the feast. Otherwise, why have even 8 days? Why have 7?
No, I understand. I've learned from other teachers that they were trying to duplicate Sukkot and the Happiest Festival.
That's right. And they
were saying for the fire to be accepted.
And they celebrated in the same way. They had a lulav. That's what it said. They had boughs and green branches. That's a lulav. It's interesting. So now let's look at the account in the Gemara in Shabbos. The account in the Gemara in Shabbos, it's also reflected in several other sources, the Psikta Rabasi as well. My Hanukkah, this is the classic, to quote Rabbi Friedman, this is the locus classicus of the Hanukkah story. My Hanukkah, the Taru Rabbanan, the Kav Hei B'Kislev, Yomei de Hanukkah Temanya Inu. There are 8 days of Hanukkah. The Lola Misbet Behon U De Lola's Anoslon. What are the primary features of Hanukkah? No eulogies and no fasting on Hanukkah. Shikishenichnesu Yevanim Lehechal. When the Greeks, Yevanim also the Midyatnim, the Hellenized Jews, they entered the sanctuary. Timu kol hashmanim shebehechal. They had defiled all the oil. Ukshegavra malchus beis hashmonai venitzchu. When the Hasmoneans came in and they were victorious, this is important, Badku velo matzu elapach echad shel shemen sheyam gunach bechotamo shel kohen gadol. They only found one cruse of oil. That's one of the words that you would never know unless you had a Jewish education, right? The cruse is a flask of oil that was sealed with the seal of the Kohen Gadol. The Lohaya Boel Hadlik Neyom Echad. There's only enough for 1 day. Nasa Bones Veliku Imenu Shmona Yamim. And they were able to light from it for 8 days. Doesn't say that it burned continuously for 8 days. It said that they were able to light from it for 8 days. It's an interesting. Lishana Acheres, and then the next year, and the Kivaum Ve'asaum Yamim Tovim Dalel Ve'Hoda'ah. They established it as a day for rejoicing with Hallel and with thanks. So this is the account of the Gemara that says that the reason that we have 8 days, not Sukkot, but the oil. Now there is the Psikta Rabasi. I actually don't have it on this sheet. That's an oversight on my part. Says that the reason that we have that we celebrate this day is that when the Hashmonaim came into the Mikdash, it had nothing to do with the oil. They took the spears that they used to defeat the Romans, and they lit candles on those spears. So what is the most important point? It wasn't the candles actually. It was the military victory, which is something that Chazal downplay in subsequent literature. Interesting, even in modern literature, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach writes, no, the main thing that we celebrate on Hanukkah is the military victory. That all those other things are very nice, but really the main thing is the military victory. And the oil. The oil is, it's true, there was oil, but the main thing is the military victory, which is no less of a miracle considering that it was a classic case of rabim biyad me'atim, the many in the hands of the few, the weak in the strong in the hands of the weak, and Seidim biyad oskei torasecha. Rav Hirsch explains that at least refers to the battle between the Jews and the Hellenized Jews. Seidim implies mezid, that implies deliberate transgression of the Torah, and the Zaydim, they were placed in the hands of Oskei Toratzecha, the few Jews that were left, that were still adhering to tradition. So we have now three different versions, two in Chazal and one in the Apocrypha. One in the Apocrypha was what? 8 days for Sukkot, and also for
the
rededication. So we don't really actually find, in Chazal, it doesn't really talk so much about the rededication. It talks about the initial action of lighting the menorah, looking for the cruse of oil and finding one that ended up lasting for 8 days. That's the Gemara in Shabbos, and the Psikter Abasi and other sources. The main thing that we celebrate is the victory. You had a question. Okay, you had a question. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So in the book of Maccabees, there's nothing about Nero.
Nothing.
So
not a word.
What I'm trying to kind of specify is how do the people who wrote the added stuff, the Gemara and so on, how did they know that it was Nero?
So very good. First of all, That's very good. So first of all, that's why we have diverging accounts. Some of it is, and we'll see that some of it might be because there was reason to omit certain things in the Gemara, and there was reason to include it in other sources. Others might be because it was a tradition that was passed down. And there are many events that were actually contemporaneous with at least the redaction of certain parts of the oral Torah. I mean, remember that the Gemara is actually a distillation of the oral tradition. So this is part of the oral tradition. So that's your answer.
But if it was true, why wasn't it written in the Book of Maccabees?
You don't have to write everything.
What is true?
So that's maybe another class. It was not. I think we actually had this discussion on Friday night. Part of the reason may be that it wasn't viewed to be actually a holy work. It wasn't. It was more of a historical account. It wasn't necessarily written Beruach HaKodesh. It didn't contain any. There's no prophecy in the Book of Maccabees. Yeah.
Would one think that if Sukkot was the paradigm for the celebration of Hanukkah, some mention of which Kobanoth and how they sacrificed, they built an altar?
Right.
But all they did was the Lulav and Esrog, maybe.
Right, so I think that the operative words here are after the manner of the Feast of Tabernacles. In other words, it wasn't the complete facsimile of Sukkot. They didn't sit in this, and that's why we don't celebrate Hanukkah like we celebrated Sukkot. If that were really, there was a certain framework that they think that Sukkot is a festival. That was the last festival they missed, so we should celebrate it in something approximating the way that we celebrated Sukkot. It doesn't mean that it's exact, but it's a good question.
What category is that?
It's what's called Sparim Chitzonim, the books that did not quite make it. There is a whole apocryphal literature, a whole group of books that almost made it to the semifinals, right? And they were not canonized. They didn't make it into the Tanakh.
What's the last?
The Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the governing body, the last prophet.
What's the last word in that Hebrew term?
Anshei Knesset HaGedolah.
No. Sparim.
Hachitzonim. Chitzonim. External.
Hachitzonim.
Yeah. Yeah. You could also, by the way, find it on the internet.
Oh, sure.
Which is actually what I did right here on the. For this.
It's
how revisionist history constantly takes place.
What do you keep in? What do you put out?
In particular, in the 20th century, mm-hmm. this story has resonated for all of us, especially since Pretzel, when he wrote his original thesis to the restoration, based it on Hanukkah.
Right.
Lighting of the candles.
That's right. That's right. So different.
In return. That's the way he saw his return.
Right.
Completely.
Different people take different parts of the Hanukkah. So for others, it's the military victory that is, and that may be why Chazal later downplayed the military victory aspect, because they wanted to focus on Hanukkah as a spiritual day rather than a physical celebration. Also, despotic.
The first guerrilla warfare.
Despotic. Well, we're going to talk about that one moment. And also, the fact that actually Hanukkah was a civil war. And Chazal may have wanted to downplay that aspect because it was actually Jew versus Jew. Really, you had families that were facing each other across the ideological and literal battlefield. So Chazal may have wanted to downplay that. But I'll tell you who didn't want to downplay any of that, and that was Josephus. But you had a question.
Yes.
An account of the Maccabees. Mm-hmm. Who authored? It's a good question. It may have been the Maccabees. I'm actually not certain of the answer to that question. Let's read a little bit of Josephus and see whether, in his account of Hanukkah, he was trying to play to the Romans, see if it would play in Rome, or whether he was trying to be balanced. Okay. When therefore he had carefully purged it, we're talking about Yehuda HaMakabi, and brought in new vessels of candlestick, the table of the showbread, and the altar of incense, which were made from gold, he hung up the veils at the gates and added doors to them. And he goes and he talks about how the decorated the Beis Hamikdash. So on the 25th day of the month of Kislev, right, which the Macedonians call Apellians, they lighted the lamps that were on the candlestick. Talk about the lights. And offered incense upon the altar of incense, and laid the loaves upon the table, that's the lechem upon him, and offered burnt offerings upon the new altar, korbanos. Now it so fell out that these things were done on the very same day on which their divine worship had fallen off. It's pretty consistent, right? And was reduced to a profane and common use after 3 years' time. For so it was that the temple was made desolate by Antiochus, and so continued for 3 years. This desolation happened to the temple in the 145th year. On the 25th day of the month, Apellians, already he's using secular terms, maybe that's an example of playing for the Romans. And on the 123rd Olympiad, that's for the Greeks. But it was dedicated anew on the same day, 25th day of the month of Apellians, on the 148th year, and on the 154th Olympiad. And this desolation came to pass. According to the prophecy of Daniel, Josephus loved the prophecies of Daniel, and which was given 408 years before. For he declared that the Macedonians would dissolve that worship. Now Judas celebrated the festival of the restoration of the sacrifices of the temple for 8 days. What's he saying that it's about?
Sukkot.
No. Rededication. And omitted no sort of pleasures thereon. For he feasted them upon very rich and splendid sacrifices. And he honored God and delighted them by hymns and songs. Nay, they were so very glad at the revival of their customs when after a long time of intermission, they unexpectedly had regained the freedom of their worship. This is very important. That they made it a law for their posterity that they should keep a festival on account of the restoration of their temple worship for 8 days. And from that time to this, we celebrate this festival and call it lights. I suppose the reason was because this liberty beyond our hopes appeared to us, and thence the name was given to that festival. Listen to Josephus' thoughts. Says they made this holiday. It was for the restoration, and there was this restoration of liberty, and they call it the Festival of Lights, and I have no idea why. Does he say anything about the oil?
No.
Not a word.
Nor
the military victory. He says nothing about that. What does he talk about? The rededication. And the freedom to worship. So there are a number of different theories given as to why he might have said that. First of all, maybe he knew nothing of the miracle of the lights, or he felt it was not important. The second explanation is that actually, what was he trying to do here? And he didn't mention anything about the military victory. So another explanation given is that he was actually very concerned that Hanukkah itself would be a source of rebellion against the Romans. And he was all about keeping the peace, that you should be a good Jew and a nice Roman, and that it's all, everything is okay. So the only way that you can be a good Jew and a good Roman around Hanukkah time is if you suppress part of the Hanukkah narrative. And which part do you suppress? The lights and the military victory. At the same time, though, he couldn't forget that he was a Jew, and so he was using this is the third theory, as a way of telling the Romans that the Jews should have freedom of religion. That what are they doing? It's harmless. Let them offer sacrifices and celebrate and have a good time. There's nothing wrong with that. Let them have freedom of religion. They're not going to lead an uprising. Nothing like that is going to happen. So he played up the aspect of the rededication at the expense of the military victory and at the expense of the oil. And why do they call it lights? Because this liberty beyond their hope appeared to us. And lights is a metaphoric expression of liberty, and that's why we call it the Festival of Lights, because Hanukkah is all about freedom of religion, isn't it? It's all about the freedom to be Jewish, and that really is what Hanukkah is about in a certain sense, because that was when we were able to start practicing again and offering korbanos.
Are you saying exactly what the Book of Maccabees said?
No. Well, hold on.
There's overlap.
There is a lot, and very similar. You're correct. It's very similar, but in terms of what is highlighted, there are certain things that are more highlighted in his account and that are not quite as highlighted in the account of the Maccabees, or that more highlighted in the Book of Maccabees than in his account. And certainly, there are things that are highlighted in the literature of Chazal. I mean, Chazal don't deny that there was a Chanukah Haggadah. There's no question about that. In fact, that really does play a central role in all the narratives of Chazal, whether it was the military victory that allowed there to be a Chanukah Sabayis, or the miracle of the oil, which was an integral part of the Chanukah Sabayis. Nobody denies that. The question is, what is being played up in each of these accounts? So for Josephus, it was all about freedom of religion, right? But I'll tell you who did not believe in freedom of religion, according to Josephus. It was the Hasmoneans themselves, who were actually despotic dictators. And so here's writing to the Romans as to Alexander, his own people, were seditious against him. For at a festival which was then celebrated, when he stood upon the altar and was going to sacrifice, the nation rose upon him and pelted him with citrons, which they had in their hand, because the law of the Jews required that a feast of tabernacles, everyone should have branches of palm tree and a citron tree. This, actually, the Gemara relates this as well, that during the times of the Tzedukim, the Kehuna Gedola, being the Kohen Gadol, was actually a job that you bought. It was for sale. So the people weren't having it. So every time the Kohen Gadol was stand up, especially on Sukkot, where there was an esrog handy, they would throw their esrogim at the Kohen Gadol, which thing we have else related. And they also reviled him as derived from a captive. They questioned his lineage, and so unworthy of his dignity and of sacrifice. Now, Alexander was from the Hashmonaim, who were Kohanim. So it's one thing to insult the lineage of a regular Jew. It's quite another to insult the lineage of a Kohen. And here he's writing, so in a certain sense, one of the reasons that he's so reviled is that he's arrogant. He's playing up to the Romans how bad the Jews were, how bad the Hashmonaim were to each other, and how much the regular Jews despised them. They were not so, after the honeymoon was over, the Hashanan really were not so great. In fact, the Chazal themselves were not afraid of mentioning this, actually. It should be pointed out that in the Gemara at the beginning of Bava Basra, Daf Dalet through Daf Dalet on the base, the Gemara relates that at one point the Sanhedrin said that anybody who says they are from the family of the Hashanan actually is descended from slaves. Because they had become so far gone from their tradition and their lineage that there really was nobody left who preserved their line. At this, he was enraged and slew of them about 6,000. He also built a partition wall of wood around the altar and temple, as far as that partition within which is only lawful for the priest to enter, and by this means he obstructed the multitude from coming at him. So Josephus was not afraid of airing dirty laundry. But it wasn't just that he aired dirty laundry. It's one thing to speak the truth. But when you are actually cozying up to the Romans, and then you write things like this, what is it? It's dangerous. It was a perception. And not just by the other Jews at the time. There was a perception by later historians that Josephus was really trying to, in a certain sense, sell out the Jews to the Romans by writing these historical accounts. So this is just a few of the perspectives on the work of Josephus. It's also worth noting that Josephus' work has been invaluable in terms of archaeology and covering archaeological sites. One archaeologist studied the work of Josephus for 35 years, and his name is on the tip of my tongue, but he was able to find a Jewish settlement by really reading the words of Josephus carefully. He was able to map out where the settlement was located, and then he discovered it. So even though in his own time and in subsequent millennia, Josephus was something of a controversial and reviled figure who felt compelled to defend himself, even before later historians mocked him, we see that the works of Josephus have stood the test of time and have actually proven invaluable in the progress, not just of recounting Jewish history, but in creating Jewish history itself. Yes?
Were there any other contemporaneous accounts?
No. That's why he's considered, for example, to be the first account of Jesus. By the way, one historian, I think it was Marcus Yost, who was a Jewish historian. He had some of his own problems in terms of his historical works, but he believed that nothing that he wrote about Jesus was accurate, and that he only put that in there to get in with the Romans. Because, after all, it was the Romans that did him in, and so when he wrote an account of it, was actually a triumphalist account of the Romans, and he only put that in to get in with the Romans. But Joseph Lacker. The only thing that you could believe about Josephus is when he writes that he was born.
Who is Joseph Lacker?
Oh, he was quite a bit quite lesser known than Josephus.
Were there any non-Jewish historians at that time? 200
years ago. Yeah, really, Josephus was one of the first, to keep a history of that time period, but only a few hundred years later.
The history of the Jews is rich in drafts. They, you know, quotes Josephus at length.